Hi, this is The Reason Podcast, and I'm Nick Gillespie, and I'm here today with Catherine Mangu Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of the award-winning Reason magazine. Catherine, thanks for talking to us.
Hi, Nick.
And also with Matt Welch, the award-winning journalist, editor-at-large of Reason, and former, as am I myself, editor of Reason magazine, Matt Welch.
Heidi-ho.
So in the pre-show, we were talking a lot about just a bunch of garbage, but let's get right to the budget that Donald Trump put out last week. It seems like it was years ago, but Matt Welch, you have written a lot about budget stuff and particularly about debt, and you had a great piece in the magazine a few months ago about debt denialists. What was your walk, you know, what's your takeaway from the Trump budget?
It's a continuation of that thing that we have seen, which is that both major political parties in this country have given up even rhetorically nodding in the direction of seeing our mountainous, almost exponentially growing debt in the combination with the kind of overhang and growing cost of the baby boomer retirement and entitlement state as a problem. They just stopped. They gave up with their magical thinking here. Trump's budget, at very least, best thing about it is that it promises flat year-over-year spending, $4 trillion to $4 trillion. I don't know what the final exact number, but it's more or less in that range, which is better than saying that we want to increase spending. But it's not sufficient at all, because it's nowhere in line with the revenues being taken in. And we have $20 trillion in debt, which is kind of a lot. And he specifically is not touching the main engines of the drivers of the debt, which are precisely entitlement state, military spending, which he's going to goose by $53 billion, or you know, he's proposing to. Let's all remember that the president doesn't write budgets. And so he's created this fantasy world in which Congress will simultaneously increase the military budget, which they totally want to do. They've been champing at the bit to do this thing for a long time, and they will do. There's no question in anybody's mind that they'll do this. However, he's paying for all of this by super deep proposed cuts in the regulatory state, 24-25% for the EPA, just across the board, large slashing year-over-year cuts in regulatory agencies, which I suspect that the three of us and most of the people listening to us would be high-fiving about. That's great. I'm glad that he did that. But let's not pretend like that's going to happen,
yeah,
right? Because what have we seen since the introduction of this budget? We've seen the exact same undifferentiated, hyperbolic, mainstream media / left of center freak out about choking grandmothers to death in the street because the Meals on Wheels program, which, Nick, I hope you elucidate further for us when it comes back around, is going to be cut. And so the political climate, the default political media climate, political class climate, is hysteria in the face of all this kind of stuff, which, yes, you would be able to point to that and say, oh, it's hysterical, and maybe it won't win the day. But members of Congress are already running screaming from constituent town halls about Obamacare. They're not going to feel the political courage to defend each and every one of these steep cuts to sometimes popular either programs or just agencies or areas of spend. Most Americans, they like environmental regulation. They don't wake up in the morning pissed off about the EPA necessarily. Some of them do, but it's not a hot button issue. So yes, the budget itself is flat year over year, although, as you have pointed out very convincingly, Nick, that is totally inadequate to the problem at hand. But even with that caveat, it's based on fantasy. What's going to happen is the eventual spending, you can guarantee it, especially in the face of an irresponsible Congress that does not actually pass budgets anymore. It passes a year-end cromnibus where it just stuffs everything in there. You can bet that the overall figure is going to be much higher, or at least significantly higher, than what this $4 trillion there. And so we're going to make a very bad debt problem worse.
Catherine, I don't know about you, but I was getting some chills there because Matt Welch was reminding me of a great Midwestern song writer named Mr. Bob Seger, and he was bringing the thunder. Catherine,
I was getting a little more of a like sinners in the hands of an angry God vibe off of him, which I was really enjoying myself. So
do you,
we can each hear it through our own lens.
Yeah. And, but you're not a Congregationalist. You're not, a daughter of the Mayflower. And it's kind of interesting that you would go for Jonathan Edwards too, because isn't he a Harvard man as opposed to a Yale man? I
don't discriminate.
Okay.
I'm a true American. You
grab onto any Ivy Leaguer and hang on to him like,
I see all
grim
Ivy Leaguers.
Death himself, yes. Even Dartmouth, come on.
Well,
and Brown.
Yeah. Don't test me.
So about the budget stuff, I mean, Matt, you know, what Matt is talking about and what Donald Trump was talking about was, we spend about $4 trillion a year. He was talking about the so-called discretionary budget, which is about $1 trillion a year. And it's an even up trade where he's just taking $54 billion from, various programs and giving it to defense and homeland security. I guess two things, and because you're the millennial, I mean, this is the most demographically diverse podcast in history, because we have a baby boomer in me, we have a Gen Xer in Matt, and we have a millennial in you. How does the budget hit you when you hear conversations about it, and particularly about the debt, which is the problem? I mean, and more so than Matt and I, actually, you're getting screwed. Your generation is getting screwed by having massive debt, which then produces lower or helps make it easier for lower economic growth over your entire adulthood. How do you factor in when you hear budget conversations? Are you just like, I don't really give a shit? Or do you get mad?
So from my own libertarian perspective, this is like the worst case ever of being proven right. You know, this idea that we had a Republican president who literally just took money out of the things that lefties like and dumped it into the things that righties like, which is, what I've always said is basically the dynamic. But to see it so black and white in the Trump budget was a thing indeed to behold. Speaking generationally, though, people imagine that D.C. is run on these sort of fancy cocktail parties in the Hay Adams. I have now learned that the other place where DC is run is the birthday parties of 3-year-olds on Saturday mornings. So, I was at a birthday party for a 3-year-old on Saturday morning with a bunch of people who are my age and have young kids and are sort of trying to figure out how to make policy in the Trump era or for our generation. And one thing that I was really struck by was the sort of generalized despair about the debt question. I mean, people couldn't even think or talk about that, even in conversations about the budget, because it just seems so intractable. Even when people who are using small government rhetoric don't decrease the deficit, much less the debt, everyone sort of understood that entitlements are the elephant in the room and that there's zero appetite to even think about addressing those. At the same time, I also heard very little of the demagoguing of stuff like Meals on Wheels cuts are going to leave seniors to starve. People sort of understood that that was the same as saying, cutting public broadcasting means we have to strangle Big Bird and leave his body in a swamp, right? Like that's not true. There are products that people
Big Bird
still
is already on HBO. So yeah, Big Bird has flown the nest, right?
Right, right. I think the sort of lack of patience with the little things that everyone decides to flip out about, but also utter complete existential despair about the prospect of addressing the debt, which that's how I feel. I mean, we're going to get screwed by it, and I just can't particularly see a road out when even people who use the rhetoric of cuts are actually just reallocating.
Matt, for you, I mean, do you feel this way too? Or, because I wrote a piece last week about how, and I was building off of stuff that Scott Shackford, one of our colleagues, had done. But, Meals on Wheels, the community development block grant program, which funds part of Meals on Wheels, was on the chopping block. And the Democrats, like before I even had seen the budget summary that Trump had put out, I received an email from the DNC saying, you know, Trump is killing Meals on Wheels. He's killing seniors as much as if he was putting a gun to their head and, you know, dropping their bodies off the Malibu cliffs. And, you know, like, are we ready to have this adult conversation about federal spending? Because, like, we have been for, you know, most of the past 30 years, we've been spending much more than we've been bringing in terms of revenue, and that builds debt, it builds deficit every year, builds debt, which over time, and we all know this in our personal lives, it makes it harder to get going and like to get on with your economic life. Are you guys confident that we're getting to that point where we can have that serious conversation? Because it's not about Meals on Wheels, and it's not about PBS, and it's not even about the EPA taking a 20 or 30% budget cut. I mean, it's really about changing the size, scope, and spending of government in a significant way in our lives.
No, we're further away from having a serious conversation because there is no interest. There's no significant block of people who have or are near power who have any incentive to have that conversation right now. Unlike that we saw back when the House of Representatives were controlled by Republicans, but in opposition to Barack Obama and in opposition to Harry Reid's Senate, when you had that kind of political competition and you had some muscle memory of Republicans pretending to care about fiscal discipline when they don't have power, and you had a Tea Party movement that was largely about related issues, there was a pretty interesting sustained national conversation about this, particularly as pegged to the debt ceiling, which was the only one of the kind of brinksmanship tools that the Republicans used during that protracted season of constant negotiations and cliffs that the American public supported them on. They'd be like, hey, you know what? We shouldn't just always raise the debt ceiling. Let's put some limitations on that, and let's use that as an excuse or as a reason to tackle long-term budget outlook. So that was in the air then, but as soon as Republicans retook the Senate in 2014, they rather quietly waived the debt ceiling out of existence, which is incredible to this day. And it's my theory, which I repeat, but no one else seems to, but that was one of the, not the dominant reason by any stretch of the imagination, but it was one of the reasons why Rand Paul's campaign never really got off the ground, was that one of his great issues that kept him on the Sunday talk shows constantly, and which was part of the national conversation every day for about 3 years there, disappeared overnight, which was the problem of the budget and the debt and the long-term outlook right now. That's not in play anymore, period, because both parties are, they've gone away from it. The media is never going to remember its own sins in the two other periods of time when we saw similar freakout. We're in the third 21st century hysteria over horrible budget slashing, right? The first came after the financial crisis of 2008, when suddenly the terrible Austerians were going to throw every single school teacher into a moat and under some alligators. We just keep going with this. And then throw Bob Seger in after them. And Big Bird. So that was a huge freak out about all these things that never really happened. And we had a fun time at Reason at the time pointing out some of these scare stories. It was usually as expressed on states, which had, as we pointed out, no one else did, just spent the previous 5 years jacking their budget by 80%. So for me, the big
problem with austerity is that there were like 4 out of 5 military bands were going to be cut. So like, you know, the Marine harmonica band was going to be cut completely. And, you know, how could you fight 2 or 3 losing wars without as many military bands as you had when you started? It was over, Matt.
Yeah, and that's related to the sequester round of media hysteria. And the sequester was just basically we flattened federal spending. But we did have at least 1 year-over-year cut on military spending, at least the Pentagon budget. And with that, and go back and look at it, and I did on the last post I wrote on this, we've kind of forgotten how ridiculous people were being. Barack Obama said an entire generation is going to lose we're going to lose an entire generation of scientists because of the sequester cut. Like, what the fuck? are you even talking about? So we've seen these panics in the past, and we're seeing another one right now. Yet the overall picture of it is that fiscal year 2000, all governments in the United States combined spent around $3.2 trillion, which adjusted for inflation, that's around $4.5 trillion now. Right now, we spend $7 trillion combined. And on the federal level, it's gone up from $1.8 trillion, was the last budget for Clinton, to it's around $4 trillion today. The population hasn't grown that fast since then. It's grown about 15% or a little bit less. So that is the baseline that no one talks about except us at this point, and maybe a handful of remaining actually principled kind of Tea Party Republicans in Capitol Hill, the Justin Amash crew. That's it. Everyone else doesn't talk about it. So to answer your damn question, Nick.
I don't even know what it was, but
It was, you know, are we going to have a serious conversation? No, yeah. We are not.
So we are not grown up yet. We're still in the awkward teenage phase. Which
is also, I mean, in particular with the EPA cuts, right? I mean, it's the same thing. You know, we've lost a generation of scientists. You know, even cutting the EPA, whatever it is, 27%, it takes us to the spending levels of the early mid-aughts, right? This is not an era in which the air was unbreathable and the water was undrinkable and we all wallowed in squalor due to the degradation of the state of the environment.
You are so naive, Catherine.
Yeah, I'm not so young that I don't remember the early aughts, I swear. And you know, the idea that somehow, again, this will be catastrophic for the country is the natural consequence of people who don't want the cuts to sort of exaggerate the harms, but they are exaggerations.
Yeah, is that, I mean, though, that, you know, and this is, it's hard to give Trump credit, especially because he's switching spending, total overall spending from one part of government to the other. But it's kind of good to even throw out there the idea that, like, you know what, the EPA, the FDA, Meals on Wheels, community block grants, like, you know, that this stuff can and should be subject to a massive hacking, even if he's talking about adding, you know, billions of dollars to build a, you know, stupendously dumb border wall. He's a very imperfect messenger, but
Mexico's paying for that, Nick. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah, and by Mexico he means America, but
American consumers. Yeah, just to be.
But
totally
I mean,
fair.
Is there at least something that we can salvage from that of putting out imperfect messenger? You know, all of that, but the idea of saying, you know what, let's just get rid of a bunch of shit that we have been paying for a long time, or that has grown in size, but we don't need it to perform the basic functions of government. Or, you know, Douglas Holtz Eakins, who was a Bush administration economic advisor, he said, you know, this was not a budget because it didn't include any of the detail or any of the kind of economic forecasting, much less a message that was clear and coherent. You know, is this document worse than nothing? In terms of kind of getting us at least onto the idea that certain things can be cut back to what Matt was talking about. And it is bizarre, like 2000 doesn't seem that far, you know, in the past, but it was a radically different world in terms of government spending.
Yeah, I think it actually is better than nothing. And I think it's true because of a very simple human psychological fact where we anchor ourselves on available points, right? So if the places where we were previously anchoring ourselves were, it is essentially counts as a cut if government doesn't grow, or maybe government will grow. Those were like the two ends of the spectrum. And now, at least in terms of the regulatory agencies, we can say, okay, our anchor point is actually a 30% cut. That's not going to happen. As you and Matt have both rightly noted, there is no way on God's green earth that we will get even close to that in reality, not least because Trump's budget does not give the tools to get there. You know, Holtz Eakin is right about that it is a skinny budget in the sense that it is very slim on detail, not in the sense that it is lower in spending. But when you go into the Best Buy and you're trying to decide between the expensive microwave, the middle microwave, and the cheap microwave,
all of which are spying on you,
right? Which are all spying on you. probably the expensive microwave is more likely to spy on you, right? Because it has to be like a smart microwave. I don't know.
Would almost demand it. That explains the surveillance button right next to popcorn, but before pizza.
But you know what? Yeah. It's weird because when you push the surveillance button, the popcorn is done perfectly. It's fantastic. So, right. So I think the anchoring element of this is good. But I think on the flip side, the idea that we're still using the rhetoric of cuts and fiscal responsibility and, you know, Republicans, you know, paring things down to the bone for a budget that is not actually smaller than its predecessors, you know, we lose. We still lose.
All right. I'm not sure that I have a lot of will to live after that. But Matt and Catherine, why don't we talk, why don't we shift from the federal budget to the Bezos bot as a kind of palate cleanser. What is going on with the Bezos bot, named after Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon and a occasional contributor to the Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes this site? Catherine, Bezos bot, please.
So I think it is only nicknamed the Bezos bot. It is technically the Method 2, and it's made by a Korean company. So take that, Donald Trump, yeah. I guess. It looks exactly like the robots in Avatar, which turns out to be because one of the designers of this robot works in Hollywood doing concept sketches for movie robots. It's gigantic. Jeff Bezos sat in the middle of it at his big conference, his sort of big think conference this weekend, and waved its arms around. It seems to actually not be able to do anything more than wave its arms around and look super badass. But I, for one, welcome our Bezos bot overlords, as I always do. The conference itself is actually a very interesting phenomenon. It's basically Amazon people getting together to talk about machine learning, home automation, robotics, and space exploration. So it's all of the kind of out there stuff that our nation's mega billionaires are getting up to these days.
Well, you know, you had a recent it was a really great conversation that's up at Reason where you interviewed Tyler Cowen of the Mercatus Center and of George Mason University's economics department, who has a great new book out or an interesting new book out. Let's put it that way. The Complacent Class. Does, like, following what's going on at Amazon, does that give you a sense that we're not as complacent as people like Peter Thiel and Tyler Cowen think? Are we still dreaming big dreams of the future?
So Tyler would say no. He explicitly addresses, I don't think Jeff Bezos, but Elon Musk in his book. And that is one of the it's a really interesting book. He basically tries to corner the market on both optimism and pessimism by saying, we don't think big anymore. We're not dedicated to big causes anymore. We don't have faith in the American experiment. When we innovate for convenience rather than for sort of paradigm shifting or you know, revolutionary change. Jeff Bezos is really one of these innovators for convenience. And even, you know, the phrases like machine learning and home automation and robotics and space exploration sound big, but in fact, what we're talking about here is, you know, your Alexa that you shout at to buy you more detergent without having to actually get up off your fat ass. And you know, by robotics, we mean the Roombas that are running around these Amazon
there's one
fulfillment centers
purring somewhere contentedly in my house as we speak.
Yes. So I think he is right about that point. The question is essentially whether all of this eventually leads us to some kind of civilizational decay or whether our complacency is the correct response to a pretty good life. He says a little more the former. I'm tempted toward the latter, but
well,
when the Bezos bot comes for us all, I guess Tyler will be proven right.
Well, and, you know, if we're Amazon Prime customers, I hope the Bezos bot comes for us first, right?
It comes quicker. You know? Comes first. Yeah, yeah. 2 days.
But I mean, do you have a sense of, and Matt, please also talk in as the child of, as you wrote about, I think, very movingly in the Declaration of Independence, as a child of post-war affluence, like, is there, you know, does complacency, Catherine, come from, you know, obviously we had the 2008 fiscal crisis, which was a big thing. And I think, you know, as we go back, it'll both, as we look back, it will both become more and more of a major part of the aughts, but also less of one. But do you need that kind of connection to, like, when I think my parents were older when they had me, and they talked all the time about being immigrants and being poor, and then the Depression hit, and then World War II, and then they got rich. Do you need that kind of disruption or that at least reveal of some kind of horrific economic event to push away from? Or do we just get complacent? Because somebody like Jeff Bezos, I mean, in a way, it's right to say he's just marginally improving. The Kindle Fire is a much better and cheaper, and I say this as a consumer of both products, it's a much cheaper and better version of the iPad, but it's not the iPad. And the iPad itself is not such a big deal. But, you know, are we complacent to a fault where, you know, just marginally improving things, is that enough, or do we need a paradigm shift?
So Tyler says that the complacent class actually is three different groups of people, that there are essentially the one percenters whose life is good and relatively insulated. There's the sort of lower middle class who are digging in to hold on because they fear losing what they have. And then there's the people he describes, I think, as being stuck, the people who didn't have opportunities and basically can't dig their way out. And so they are also just sort of accepting of their fate, perhaps grudgingly, but still, you know, part of this group of status quo advocates or status quo believers. So, you know, I think the type of innovations that we're talking about from Amazon or from Bezos are largely relevant only to the top group, though I think, as with all these things, it trickles down. I am not totally convinced about the idea that we are lacking in big projects. I mean, certainly the space exploration stuff is out there. Also, I think, you know, what Tyler says is that the project of global connectivity was the big project of the late 20th and early 21st centuries, and that's more or less complete now. But that was a big project that we did really very well and, you know, among other things, made policy around that project that didn't totally suck. Which is surprising.
And so, he's no naysayer on, like, the, you know, the incredible growth of the third, not even the third world, but I mean of people in absolute poverty, et cetera. I mean, he's always been very good at acknowledging, you know, real material advances in everyday life for billions of people.
But he does say that it's possible that both the kind of Black Lives Matter, anger demonstrations, riots, and also possibly Trump's election are signs of coming disruptions that could create that sense of urgency or emergency or, need to rapidly innovate that you're describing your parents as having and which immigrants to this country still have.
And all I can say is, you know, thank God it wasn't up to my parents or any of my relatives to come up with the transformative, improvements in American life. I mean, they were literally and figuratively good soldiers in that, but they weren't going to be, they weren't going to be thinking of it. Matt, as a California transplant into Brooklyn, where does optimism go to die for you?
So I think one problem is that even libertarians, even Nick Gillespie, for crying out loud, can flirt with a kind of reverse engineering view of the world by which you look around, and maybe this applies to Tyler Cowen, I don't know, and say, damn, where's our great...
I do want to point out that Tyler Cowen is, like all great libertarians, from New Jersey, and his father was the head of the Chamber of Commerce in Alpine, New Jersey.
Gene Healy a great libertarian, then
Gene Healy lives in the same town as Bruce Springsteen, so he's got something going on there.
But yeah, money at this point. Yeah. We tend to think of where is our grand project, and I see no grand project, so we must be doing something differently. We all of us, even the most hardcore, spontaneous order fan, end up discounting what happens when people just do shit. This is going to sound like a weird example, that will display my own technical ignorance. But so there I am. I'm watching the World Baseball Classic like a man. And they're they have this recurring commercial that I absolutely do not understand. It's some like a weird kind of almost dandy steampunk guy with an accent wearing a vest and saying, "What are you looking for? I give you adventure. I give you life. I sell you nightmares." And like, what? It doesn't make any sense. And he eventually like throws a blade at the door and it opens up. And then it turns out this was all an advertisement for, I think, a video game platform. But everything that it referred to, including the video game, I didn't even begin to understand any of it. And I realized I just opted out of this thing that happened in the last 20 years. And it's a huge thing as we explored in our video game nation issue like 2 years. But like, what the hell? Does this improve people's lives? Is this the thing that Tyler Cowen was looking for? No, it just was a thing. And then it happened because people are screwing around with stuff. The space exploration, I had a great moment that I encourage people to go look at, and I think I blogged it at Hit and Run at some point, where I was on there with Lou Dobbs. And Nick, you obviously know that if I'm going to be sitting next to Lou Dobbs on any panel, I am going to work in a reference to space.com. And it was great because there was actually a tangentially space-related question. Former lead singer or some shit 90s band apparently had sent the WikiLeaks emails had shown that he had sent an email to John Podesta about the aliens or something, and so I just used that as a thankfully we have an expert on space next to us, and I'm sure that he will tell us that it's a good idea to explore the heavens and blah blah blah. He used that as a reason to tee off on Barack Obama for gutting NASA, and as you can well imagine, Catherine. I teed off right back at him and said, "Dude, you should know that this is one of the only areas that free market types, libertarians and others, have given Obama at least a pinky high five on, partly because he sort of lifted some restrictions on people's abilities to go and tinker with shit. And when we lift those restrictions, and Nick and Catherine, we were at the Reason Weekend this past weekend, and Nick did this great interview with the founder of Flying Dog Brewery, which gets to the whole kind of craft beer deregulation. When they deregulated home brewing in 1978, they didn't know this was going to lead to America going from the worst beer country in the world to the best. But that's what happened. So we look at the Grand Project and we're sad that it's not happening. But we always, always, always discount the weird magic creativity of what happens when you kind of get out of people's way. It's not going to happen like you planned it. And that's the point, Nick.
Amen.
Yeah, you know what? Sing it, brother Matt. Sing it. And, you know, this seems to me like as good a time as any to work in a quick conversation about Chuck Berry, you know, the father of rock and roll and of toilet cams, to be quite honest. He covered the waterfront in terms of innovation. But, you know, Matt, this was years ago, and you'll enjoy this. I went to, and I think it's to date, my first and only Mont Pelerin Society meeting, where the group that Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises and Milton Friedman and R.S. Crane, a famous literary critic of the time, created after World War II to keep alive the idea of classical liberalism. But I was on a panel actually talking with Tyler Cowen, now that I remember, about culture and capitalism and, you know, is it good or bad? And Vaclav Klaus was in the audience, as well as a guy who went on a big rant about how when public schools, you know, stopped teaching opera or something, you know, everything went to hell in a handbasket in the 50s. And I was like, you know, the one thing you can say about rock and roll, or what the one thing you can say about public school in the 50s is that it created rock and roll. It created these sideburned delinquents, male and female. And Chuck Berry died. Catherine, you obviously, it's rare that you don't start the day at Reason in the DC office playing Johnny B. Good at maximum volume. Do you miss Chuck Berry? And is he our Apollo project? Is he our cultural Apollo project?
No and no.
Can you name a single Chuck Berry song?
Sure, but only because I got the Wikipedia entry up right now.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Wikipedia is our Apollo project.
Yeah,
now
that which is actually
that's true. I mean, by the way, no one was paying attention. We assembled all of human knowledge for basically for free.
It's the online encyclopedia that everyone can edit. And you wrote a great feature about that early on, which these are the things and I mean actually I do want to talk about Chuck Berry and rock and roll for a second, but it's also it is, to Matt's point, it is something like Wikipedia will never show up in, like, you know, when CNN or whatever succeeds CNN in 20 years, it was talking about how great everything was. Like, they'll use Wikipedia, but they won't mention it. And it's, how many conversations have humans had, certainly in the developed countries, that have been, founded completely upon Wikipedia. It's an amazing addition to a supplement to what was not there even 15 years ago.
Are you ready to see that in action?
Yeah.
Here's the thing that I want to share with our listeners about Chuck Berry, which I just learned by reading Wikipedia. Apparently, he largely performed only for cash in the 1970s, thereby making it easy for him to evade paying his income taxes. So let's just all remember that he eventually did have to plead guilty to tax evasion, and he did 1,000 hours of community service, including benefit concerts, in 1979. American hero Chuck Berry.
This is for those of us of a certain age. The things you remember about Chuck Berry, not Chuck Barris, who's his own kind of great as well, the inventor of the dating game and the Gong Show. And Matt, back me up on this, but it's My Ding-a-Ling. Which was the Chuck Berry song that was big in the 70s. It was actually a hit, showing up and doing tax evasion concerts, and then the decline of him in a restaurant called the Southern Airs in St. Louis, where he got into trouble and had to fix a class action suit against people who said that he put cameras in the women's room for various sordid reasons.
My Ding-a-Ling is arguably one of the best rock and roll songs about a man's penis that's ever been in the charts.
Was it? I didn't realize it was about that. I thought it was a feel-good song just about going out on a date.
Also, there's also some phallic imagery in the song Detachable Penis. I don't know if you were aware of that as
Is
well.
Is that also a Chuck Berry song? Or
turns out that it was not. To tie it all together, obviously, Chuck Berry's music was put on one of the Voyager rockets, the one that went out and was going to, in case we met the aliens, they have to
aliens with a with an analog stereo system.
Yeah, they have to listen to the song that Michael J. Fox taught Chuck Berry how to play. If there's anyone out there who is interested, unlike Catherine Mengi Ward, in Chuck Berry and have not seen the Taylor Hackford rockumentary Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll from the late 80s, please rectify that situation. You can actually watch it free online because of YouTube and copyright law violations out there. It's super great. It was when Chuck Berry was turning 60, and Keith Richards, who was almost dying at the time, and seriously, he was messed up. He decided to organize an appreciative concert from him, and then Chuck and with all these stars that came in. And what was great is that Chuck Berry, first of all, Keith Richards forced him to rehearse, which he never does. He just hires a backup band, never talks to them, throws $12 at them, treats them very badly on stage, does the duck walk, and leaves. So Keith Richards runs him through his paces, like, no, the band's got to practice. And then Berry, with just decades worth of hatred towards Keith Richards for stealing his licks, sits there and keeps telling Keith Richards, no, you're playing it wrong, over and over again. It's phenomenal. It's appropriation at its finest.
And, Back to the Future, obviously, there's that moment at the end of the first Back to the Future movie, which, and I'm not sure we need to talk about Back to the Future in terms of sequels, but in Back to the Future, where Michael J. Fox invents rock and roll, and his cousin, I think his name is Marvin, calls up Chuck Berry and says, this is the future, which bent a lot of people the wrong way, because it is true that Chuck Berry, as a black man, as a musician, as obviously a tormented soul in many, many ways, had a really shitty life of it. I guess before we turn to other aspects of kind of contemporary American life, you know, how is it worth dealing with the idea that Chuck Berry, as a black guy in the 50s, who, along with a couple of other people, both black and white, who invented rock and roll, was treated incredibly shabbily, both by the business world, and, you know, part of it was his own doing, but also by our social world? Like, do we need to address that, or how do we acknowledge that while moving into the future, Catherine or Matt? Or do we need to?
Well, again, that the Hail Hail Rock and Roll documentary gets into that pretty well, and I forget the exact scene, but he has a very vicious severe bitter memories of not being allowed in certain parts of a theater, I believe in St. Louis, which is where his hometown was, and he holds on to that for a really long time. And it also talks about how, and Keith Richards is great on this in the interviews section of it, how his music was adapted from black blues from piano. All of the songs right. that he plays are not in guitar keys; they're in bar chord keys that are better on piano, like B. And all that's interesting, and it pulses through his music. It's funny, you listen to him now, and one thing that I like about just the mixed up, screwed up history of rock and roll is that it's constant borrowing back and forth between, you know, what otherwise musicologist types would like to hermetically seal in their own categories of music. You listen to Chuck Berry now, and if you just had to ask someone who'd never heard Chuck Berry, and you said, is that dude white or black? You would say white. You would totally say white, just because his lyrically, he wrote more lyrics per second than anyone, enunciated everything like Eddie Murphy trying to act like a white guy kind of thing. And it was actually arguably as much of a contribution to rock and roll as anything else. Mick Jagger had a great little appreciation for him on Twitter, and saying just he painted this kind of stream of consciousness word picture that allowed outsiders to imagine this great rock and this great American landscape. It was like almost reading Jack Kerouac for the first time if you were a British school kid. Like, wow, this all these sort of details and scenes, you know, almost kind of like a proto Bob Seger, Nick, talking about the great areas of the country. I mean,
my next book, The Climatology of Bob Seger, Rock and Roll Genius, will be coming out in 2024. I agree. And to bring it back to both to Catherine and to Tyler Cowen, Maybelline, I think it's Maybelline, actually has a co-credit by Alan Freed, who is the DJ who popularized the term rock and roll and then got swept up in the payola scandals of the 50s, ended his recording or DJing career in Palm Springs, Matt. I know you love Palm Springs, California. But Tyler had written a book about how, or not a book, but an essay about how payola was great because it gave regional labels, which were the only ones who would do rock and roll in the 50s early on, it gave them a way to get to market. But Catherine, do you muse much? Did you play a long set list off of YouTube for your kids of Chuck Berry songs so that they would understand where they come from as Americans and where they might be headed as first or second generation Mars colonists?
My children only like Katy Perry.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm so sorry, America. No,
that's kind of great. I saw Katy Perry perform in D.C. a couple of years ago, and one of the things that was hilarious about it was that she gave, you know, where she's going to take it down a little bit after doing all of her like big kind of Coliseum or, you know, big stadium hits. She had like an intimate concert and she went on a rap that was actually kind of fucking great for about 15 minutes about how, like, you know, she, like other people in America, you come from nothing and you imagine what you want to be and then you become it. And it was this, you know, that's why they hate us. I'm sure that, you know, that.
And what she imagined that she wanted to be was like a person who wears giant peppermint candies as a bra. Who could hate that?
Who doesn't? No, I mean, you know, come on. It's, you know, back when, for me, it was Hall's Mentalyptus, but, you know, it's the same concept. It's some kind of, no, it was actually kind of wonderful. And isn't I have a particular fetish for pop music because it allows this endless parade of freaks to individuate themselves and just create identities. And of course, last year we saw a bunch of people like Prince and David Bowie in particular die. But it's got to be kind of great that your kids are into Katy Perry, right? I mean, like, she's pretty good.
I mean, I do think that in general music has gotten better, which is, you know, I understand a thing that angers the olds. But in particular, at least dumb music has gotten better. Dumb music has gotten smarter, I think, might be a defensible position to hold. And Katy Perry would be exhibit A.
All right. So, well, let's, now that we're we're done talking about the serious stuff, can we, Matt, you have strong feelings on the nomination and the hearings of Mr. Judge Neil Gorsuch coming up. What is your fear of Neil Gorsuch?
I don't have a strong fear of him. I think that he might, because of his views, strong views against assisted suicide, and tied up with kind of, as Damon Root has a couple of great recent pieces out that I recommend people look at reason.com about this, he might transfer this into an attack on Roe v. Wade, which I would object to more on a practical basis than on a philosophical basis, just because it's a weird decision itself. But that's probably my largest concern of him. I know there's been some recent discussion that he had a part in drafting memos that kind of apologized for a Bush administration war on terror policies. I'm not sure that reflected his views. He was probably doing his job.
Yeah, he's just like, what was it that the fake Indian from University of Colorado called the little Eichmanns in the in the World Trade Center?
War Churchill.
Thank you.
Man, that's a pre-financial crisis reference. Nick.
Yeah, I actually once went to cover Ward Churchill's disciplinary hearing for the Wall Street Journal. Like, that was a thing that was happening.
That was
in the world.
So important. Yeah. No, and I remember thinking the little Eichmanns line, because you know in post World War II America, you hear a name like Eichmann and it sounds German, but I assumed it was Jewish, and I was like, wow, that's like somehow an anti-Semitic slur while attacking Nazis, because at the same time that he was saying it was little Eichmanns who got what they deserved, then people like Amory Baraka, who at that point was the poet laureate of my great state of New Jersey, had written a poem about how, you know, no Jewish employees showed up at the World Trade Center that day because they had gotten advance word.
Fine piece of poetry from New Jersey's Poet Laureate also featured the rhyme Condoleezza and Skeeza.
Yeah, what kind of Skeeza? What kind of Skeeza is Condoleezza? And then
both know this is troubling.
And he mentioned, well, Matt, I hate to tell you this, but this was an extended version. In a piece, was it about the Great Gatsby or what? I can't remember now, but that I wrote for the magazine.
It's always.
Yeah, it is. But
I think under your editorship, even.
Yeah, no, that's Matt. That's why I'm asking Matt. It's like, well, I have no knowledge of this. But and he talked about like secretaries named Sharon who were like staying home in Staten Island. It's a remarkable poem by a guy who.
I would just point out that, given the minor but significant cultural rise of the alt-right, that Little Eichmanns might be a name of a good new doo-wop group.
Yeah, that would be. Yeah,
Gavin McInnes and the Little Eichmanns.
No, all the no. I am noping the fuck out of
talkie,
this plan.
The talkie tour of America, the talkie's back tour of America, the Little Eichmanns. A white doo-wop group, because, you know, whites can do everything better than Italians or blacks. Yeah.
What do you finally? That's all there were white doo-wop groups back in the day. Listen, on the Gorsuch thing, we're having those confirmation hearings today. By the time people listen to this, they've probably already seen a bunch of crap and partisan posturing. This is going to be kind of the worst peacockery of bipartisanship that we've seen, at least since the last one. What it'll show is that Democrats are trapped between the strong kind of feeling among their base of just say no to everything and the reality that Gorsuch is actually the kind of person that, if you were a Democrat worried about Donald Trump exercising too much power, he's kind of who you want. He will, because of his pretty strong feelings about not being deferential to the executive branch, he's likely the kind of person you want. Democrats are not going to block him. They're going to pretend like they're going to want to block him. He's going to get confirmed, and hopefully all this will be proven correct. So it's going to be in this extended, nauseating theater that reminds us in the first place why we would prefer to talk about Chuck Barris and toilet cams than about
large existential debt. Catherine, do you have anything to add about Neil Gorsuch? I was reminded over the weekend, I think the Wall Street Journal ran a piece about how Byron White, who was on the Supreme Court for 1,000 years after having a pretty successful college and professional football player, football career in, the 40s or 50s, his hearings took like an hour maximum, and that was because somebody tripped on the way in or something. Like, are Supreme Court not confirmation hearings now just theater? And there is actually no substantive role for them. Gorsuch, by everybody's account, is absolutely qualified to serve on the Supreme Court. Should it just be a rubber stamp?
I think they are theater, but they are a worthier kind of theater than an awful lot of the other bullshit that happens on the Hill. At least when we are talking about the confirmation of Supreme Court justices, there are real stakes, right? A life appointment for one of the most powerful people in our government. And they do typically talk in Supreme Court hearings in particular about issues of substance. Now, the nominees don't. Right. The nominees say sort of jargony things about settled law and stare decisis and whatever. But the representatives do. And I actually always find it interesting to hear the kind of language that they're using in phrasing their questions, what they think, what they anticipate will be coming down the pike that these guys will have to deal with. I'd rather have that than, for instance, the show trials where they bring in the Apple CEO and say, how come you didn't pay more taxes than you had to? As far as hearings go, they are at least semi-serious, so I'll take it.
All right. I'll take it. You know, then we've accomplished things. We can put you in that Buick SUV right now. This is what I've learned as a salesman over the years. And obviously, I'm working most of the time selling cars somewhere in the Midwest.
This explains so much.
Yeah, that, when you've got a sale, you stop the conversation immediately and go back and get the paperwork. But Matt Welch, do you have anything else to add today for the coming week? What are you excited about in this week?
I'm excited about the incipient freakout because FBI Director James Comey just confirmed that the FBI is investigating, as part of an investigation, ties with the Trump campaign. And
ooh.
Russia. So
being surveilled then, right?
He denied wiretapping of Trump Tower, but said that as part of ongoing investigations into Russian influence on the election, that there were investigations into contacts between Trump campaign people and the Russians.
Wow. Okay. And
so that's exciting.
It
so
is
this
exciting.
Is the last conversation anyone is going to have about the Gorsuch nomination.
Yeah, that sounds
this
like
is it.
Yeah.
We're done now.
I was going to ask you, Catherine, is there any is there a story this week that you're particularly interested in? Or
I was looking forward to Gorsuch, but it looks like we got another week of Ruskies, which frankly is a story that I continue to struggle to give much of a shit about. But thankfully, we have Matt Welch, who is on the news every minute.
All right. That is, it's an impressive, it's aspirational for all of us at Reason. And I think we're going to end this now. This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. We've been talking with Catherine Mangu Ward, editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and Matt Welch, editor-at-large of Reason. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.